We're back. It me, Bethany Rutter, and I'm here with my good friend and business partner.
It me, Alice Slater.
And we are, what the page are you on? How are you doing, my friend?
You know what? I'm fucking loving life. We've just recorded the novella episode, which I really enjoyed. And now we're here just jamming once again.
Yeah, so I don't even need to ask you what you're reading right now because that will not have changed. There will be no new content for our friends at home to hear about from us. So shall we, to borrow a YouTube phrase, dive right in?
Let's dive right in.
So today we're talking about women in translation. So translated fiction by female authors, which I think is pretty cool.
And we're doing that because it is Women in Translation Month. So we thought, what better time to talk about women in translation than a month which is dedicated to exactly that?
So true. I didn't know about Women in Translation Month, and I'm very glad to hear about it.
Yeah, I feel like we're not always the best at planning what we record based around, you know, shit that's happening in the literary world, but it's a whole month, so, you know.
Yeah.
We thought, why not?
So, how would we like to begin? Would we like to begin by chatting in general and then moving on to some translated fiction we've enjoyed, or the other way around?
So, I was thinking we will chat, do a general chat. I'm going to ask some questions about, like, your reading habits in terms of translated fiction, and then some of the books will come up in that chat, and then some of them we will then kind of talk about at the end.
Cool.
Okay, so let me kick us off. So in general, do you read much translated fiction?
I feel like I do, but this year I was looking at what I've read this year, and I don't think I've actually read any translated fiction. So
nothing?
I don't think so. I'm pretty sure I haven't.
Oh my god, now I feel like I need to check and see if I have.
And although I have not read any translated fiction, I did, for the first time in a long time, read a book that was entirely in a different language. So that felt like a real achievement for me.
Yeah, look at you. What language were you reading in?
Le Français.
Ooh!
So that made me feel very fancy. But yeah, I read a book in French rather than reading a translated book. Which obviously is different, but I still feel like it, you know, stimulated my brain.
So I've read like 4 translated books this year. That's not bad going, is it?
No, not bad.
5, in fact. Anyway, this isn't the purpose of this chat. So you don't necessarily specifically seek out translated work, clearly, because we're in August and you haven't read anything. But when you do, is there a specific language or country that you are more drawn to?
Not really, I don't think. Yeah, I was thinking about this, and I think, no, I mean, I think I'm just more drawn to, like, what sounds like an interesting story. And if it sounds like an interesting story to me as someone who reads books in English, I'm always interested in what makes the story different because it is from, you know, an author in translation or like an author from a culture that I am not from.
Yeah, I feel like I definitely will generally only go by like blurb, plot, yes, and like vibe. But I did notice in going through my bookshelves, I was like, oh, I'm going to try and find 10 books translated from 10 different languages. But then I found that I have an overwhelming number of Japanese texts, way more Japanese books than any other language. After that, maybe French is the next most common language to be found on my shelves.
Would you say you're specifically interested in Japan and Japanese culture as like a general idea?
No, I think that it's because, and maybe this is completely off, but I think it's purely that more Japanese fiction gets translated and catches my eye.
True.
Than any other language. But then having said that, I said in the last episode, I used the phrase, it was less sinister than I was expecting. And I do feel like that is a theme with a lot of the books I have here that I want to talk about. Books that I think I expected something more from than they perhaps delivered.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, let's just like, I'm just going to kind of throw out some titles and we can just vibe and see what we think. I was also kind of thinking about how to phrase this. Like, should it be a best of list? Should it be a top 10? Should we like aim to travel the world? And in the end, I just went with what I have because I feel like that's probably the best reflection of what I actually read. But yeah, let's start. Should we just start in Japan and we'll talk about some Japanese fiction first?
I'm down.
That's as good a place as anywhere. Okay, so for Japanese fiction, I have 5 titles that have come out in the UK over the last few years, with the exception of Kitchen by Banani Yoshimoto. Have you read Kitchen?
The only one of the Japanese books that I've read is Convenience Store Woman.
Interesting.
Yeah, and okay. By the Japanese books, I mean the ones on our shared note, not of all Japanese books in the whole world.
On our list.
Yes.
So, Banani Yoshimoto is one of the best-selling, one of the most, one of the most best-selling Japanese authors internationally. I think only after Haruki Murakami. So Kitchen is translated by Megan Backus. It's actually, the copy that I have is just Kitchen on its own, but I think when you buy it now, it comes with another short story because it's so short. Anyway, this is published in 1987, and much like a lot of Banani Yoshimoto's work, it's quite a lyrical and quite gentle text. Considering it's called Kitchen, there's not as much, like, food writing in it as you may expect. Oh, I'm so dumb. I've just noticed this version also contains Moonlight Shadow, which is the other story. But you would not know that looking at the cover at all. It doesn't mention it at all. Anyway, so Kitchen is juxtaposes two different stories about mothers, bereavement, kitchens, transness, love and tragedy. It's very cult. Bless you!
I muted myself, so, but then you didn't know I muted myself. So
no.
Yep. That's fine.
So I ruined it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's quite a cult novel, and I'd be really interested to know, because obviously I'm a cis reader, I'd be interested to know if any trans readers have read this and how they responded to the theme of gender in the book, because... Mm. Yeah, I don't really know. I don't really know if it's chill or not. I've just realised I completely forgot that was even in there.
Well, it's interesting. It's an interesting thing to think about. And I would love to hear from one of our listeners if they have any insight on that from their point of view.
Yes. Okay, so the next on the list was Convenience Store Woman, which you have read, of course.
I have read it. One of the biggest books of the last few years in translation, or possibly the biggest book in translation of the last few years.
I mean, I personally would say so.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's anything... Yeah, if there's anything bigger, then I haven't read it. IMO.
Yeah, and I feel like it's a book that probably a lot of our listeners will have read. And that was translated by Ginny Tapley Takamori.
This is a good opportunity to say that one of my real fucking pet peeves is when publishers don't put the translator's name on the cover.
Agree.
Just put it on the cover. Why do I have to hunt for it?
And, like, why would that not occur to anyone? Like, it's such a fundamental part of what that book is. Like, why would that not occur to them?
Yeah, exactly. And, like, for some of these, like, okay, at least with this, with... So I've got the... it's not a hardback. It was a French-flapped version of Convenience Store Woman instead of a hardback. It's on the inner flap. So at least I don't have to hunt that hard for it. But still, I want it front and centre.
Agree.
Okay, do you want to nutshell this one? Do we need to nutshell it? I mean, I feel like everyone knows
I feel like
it.
At this point, everyone knows what Convenience Store Woman is. It's about a woman who works in a convenience store. End of story.
Yeah, it bangs. If you haven't read it yet, then you just need to read it. I'm not going to waste any more time trying to convince you.
And much more universally liked and universally appealing than Earthlings, which was her next book, which came out this year.
And, okay... I'm just going to go on record and say it. I didn't love Earthlings.
I did like Earthlings, but I can see very much why someone would not like Earthlings.
I feel like I loved the voice, because I think that Sayaka Murata is an incredible writer and her characters feel very real and their voices are very unique. I loved Piet, the hedgehog toy. Like, I loved that whole vibe. Maybe if I reread it and the ending doesn't take me by surprise, I'll feel it a bit more. But I think Granta did this like campaign where it was like film yourself reading the last 5 pages. So there were all these videos of people reading it just being like, what the fuck did I just read? And that was very much my energy. I was like, what the fuck just happened?
It does have like the weirdest ending.
Yeah, but...
Yeah.
And yet, it's the weirdest ending, and yet I can think of another book that has that ending.
Hmm.
Sort of. But we'd have to go off record to discuss it.
Okay.
Because it's the ending. Right? It's a spoiler. Okay. And then, so you haven't read either of the next two Japanese titles, so I'm just going to, like, drop in really quickly on both of them. One is Strange Weather in Tokyo by Hiromi Kawakami. And this is my favorite. I've read a couple of her books, but this is my favorite. This one is translated by Alison Markin Powell. And like, again, like her work is quite surreal towards, well, maybe surreal is the wrong word actually. So basically this one is about a dreamlike is more what I'm looking for rather than surreal, like directly surreal. But this is about a woman who's drinking alone in a local bar. And then her old, like, high school teacher sits next to her. And she's now in her 30s and he's elderly. And they strike up this relationship. They end up regularly find themselves in the same bar. So they start sharing food and drinks. The seasons sort of pass and they end up falling in love. And it's just incredibly moving and haunting, and it's a book about loneliness as much as it is about love. And there's an incredible scene where they go mushroom picking, which I just really, really enjoyed. But yeah, it's sweetly sad, and I really liked it, and I really, really recommend it.
So I think possibly one of the, you know, when like a publisher does like the nice thing of packaging like an author's books in the same kind of way.
Yes.
Which I think is like, you know, on its face, like a nice kind of brand building thing. For me, sometimes it does then mean if I don't know much about the author, I don't know how to differentiate between the books. So I don't get a vibe of the book. I don't know how to explain it, but
okay, now I know like, exactly what you mean.
That, and I think this book maybe fell into that. So Strange Weather in Tokyo is the one with the like levitating woman on the cover, right?
So they all, because they all have photographs by a Japanese photographer called Natsumi Hayashi. She was very big on Instagram, which is how I came across her work. So they all have their photographs of, I think they're self-portraits of the photographer. And they look like she's levitating. Yeah. She's jumping with like a super slow, whatever exposure. It's called.
Yeah.
So yeah, she looks like she's floating.
Shutter speed, yeah.
That's it, yeah. I really like her work. So I really the images on the covers of these books, but I do know what you mean.
I think they're nice covers, but it has just meant that I wouldn't necessarily know where to start with, like, why would one of them appeal to me more than another?
So I think this one, Strange Weather in Tokyo, I really like it. I found it very compelling because I found the relationship very compelling. The other one of hers I've read, which I can't remember the title of it now, The Nakano Thrift Shop, that's it. Okay.
Yeah,
that one just didn't quite do it for me in the same way that Strange Weather in Tokyo did, because it didn't have as much of a plot, I felt, you know, like it's much longer and there wasn't quite the same kind of driving force behind it. So yeah, even though they all kind of blend and, you know, they look very similar on the shelves, Strange Weather in Tokyo is the standout for me.
Cool, that's good to know for me personally, the protagonist of the universe.
And then finally, I've got There's No Such Thing as an Easy Job by Kikuko Sumura. This one's translated by Polly Barton, who, side note, just had a book out from Fitzcarraldo about the Japanese language.
Yes, I thought I recognised that name.
Yeah, so she seems like a cool gal. So this one, okay, so this one, the cover is really kind of memorable. It's very millennial. It's like split half pink, half very, very pale blue kind of turquoise. Mm. And then it has a woman with her head flat on a desk, you know, with like a laptop pushed off to one side. It's really chunky. And basically it's about a woman who walks into an employment agency at the beginning of the book and says, I need a job that requires literally nothing from me. Like no reading, no writing, absolutely no thinking, just anything. And so she gets given this job of monitoring a hidden camera feed of an author who's suspected of doing something dodgy with contraband goods. And essentially the book is split into five parts. That's the first job. Each part is her doing another job because something happens with each one. Either the task comes to an end or she needs to leave. But as they progress, they get more sinister. And then the very last one is called The Easy Job in the Hut in the Big Forest. And it is so creepy. And it's just fantastic. I really loved it. I almost feel like they feel like five different novellas. Is there five? One, two, three. Yeah. They feel like individual novellas because each chapter has its own story about the people who work there, about the job itself. There is some mystery or some situation that compels her that she has to kind of figure out.
This sounds so good.
It's really good. And then there's like the overarching question is, what has happened to her? Why is she so incapable of sticking to one job? Why is she demanding
to switch jobs off that so require much. Yeah.
Yeah, like absolutely nothing from her? And it is essentially a book about burnout. That's not a spoiler. It's a book about millennial burnout. And yeah, I really liked it. As I said, it is very long, and some of them, I feel like the chapters get progressively better. But you could also just as easily just read the last one, which might sound completely wild, but yeah, you don't necessarily have to read them all. And yeah, so I really, really, really like that. I just wish it was a little bit shorter, if I'm perfectly honest, but I found myself very compelled by it, you know, considering it like moves in quite a quiet way.
Yes. No, I'm very intrigued by the sound of this book.
And then I just realised I do have one more Japanese book that I wanted to talk about, which is called The Woman in the Purple Skirt by Natsuko Imamura, translated by Lucy North. This one came out from Faber this year. I mentioned this one on Instagram, that the inner flap makes it sound, the blurb makes it sound so sinister. It sounded very like a Tessa Moshfegh to me.
Mm.
Let me pull up the quote. Okay, so the blurb is, the woman in the purple skirt is being watched. Someone is following her, always perched just outside of sight, monitoring which buses she takes, what she eats, whom she speaks to. But this invisible observer isn't a stalker. It's much more complicated than that.
Dark?
Which, you know, yeah, it sounds super dark. It's actually kind of not.
Oh.
It's very disquieting. It's a story about loneliness and parasocial relationships and the way that we may impact the lives of others around us in ways that we don't necessarily know about. And yeah, I feel like it is another book that kind of follows this trend of translated Japanese fiction about women in the world of work, like convenience store women and there's no such thing as an easy job, because it's about the workplace more so than it is about stalking. I mean, it does explicitly say it's not about stalking, but I sort of feel like it sets itself up to be about that.
Yeah.
But I actually ended up finding it incredibly moving and I ended up really liking it. So although it didn't quite deliver what I was expecting from it, I still ended up really liking what I got.
Interesting.
So, yeah. A curious little yarn. Okay, let's move on from Japan to South Korea in our traveling around the world. I just kind of slapped down one South Korean book, which we have talked about before, so maybe it's a bit boring, but The Vegetarian by Han Kang.
Agree. Translated by Deborah Smith. Yeah, I feel like this is another one of those books that, like, I would probably... It's just a kind of, you know, modern classic that I feel like I would probably recommend to a lot of people.
Did this one win the International Man Booker Prize?
I believe it did, yes. And it's just about a woman who kind of becomes increasingly restrictive about what she will eat to a point that becomes problematic for her. That's, I guess, just what the book is about. But it's just so different. Like, I just remember reading it and feeling like it was so different from anything I'd read before. It was like dealing with ideas I hadn't really thought about. It was just, yeah, I really loved it, and it does feel like a kind of really, yeah, modern classic, I guess.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And it's also one of those books that what's truly happening is very slowly revealed to you. So it starts off with just this kind of family's really extreme response to this woman deciding to become a vegetarian, and they all fucking freak out. Like, it's split into three parts with a different narrator for each part. And the first part is this man talking about his wife deciding to become vegetarian. It goes somewhere that was very unexpected, but actually really incredible.
Agree. And it's definitely an easier read than Han Kang's other book, Human Acts, which is like, yeah, it's just a bit harder to kind of get into, and I wouldn't necessarily recommend it to everyone, whereas this, I think, is just a real kind of universal banger, I would say.
Yeah, you can't say fairer than that.
True.
Next, should we move into Europe?
Or should we? Yes.
Yeah, let's move into Europe. You okay? So I've got like maybe three French books here. Yeah, three French books. One of which I know you've read, two of which I don't think you've read.
I have not read.
Okay, so we'll start with one of the ones that I've read, and then we'll do the one that you have read, and then we'll do the other one. Okay, so the first of which is called All About Sarah by Pauline Delabroix-Allard. Allard?
Delabroix-Allard.
Oh, thank God you're here. This one is translated by Adriana Hunter, who's a very prolific translator. It says here she's translated 80 books so far.
Good for her.
Yeah, very impressive. So this one, basically, I picked it up from my local bookshop. I'd never heard of it before, but it only came out relatively recently. It's about a young violinist who is this, like, really vivacious, like, kind of big character. And I think she's another unnamed narrator. Yeah, it's a woman who completely falls for this violinist. And they have this, like, really tumultuous love affair. And then it's split into two halves, and it gets really fucking dark.
Cool.
Again, like, I think having read quite a few books about obsessive love, I felt almost a little bit jaded when I read this one. And I need to reread it, because, I didn't quite... It opens with a very dark... It opens with the end, so you know what's coming. But yeah, it's also written in these vignettes, so it's also written completely out of order, describing this relationship. I just really recommend it. You know what else it reminds me of? I've just realised.
Tell
it
me.
It kind of reminds me of Julia Armfield's new book.
Mm.
In that describing the highs and lows of a relationship that's doomed.
Yeah.
Is the best way I can describe it. But yeah, I really enjoyed it. It's a very quick read. I could have put it in our novella episode, but I decided to hold it back because it's one that we haven't talked about on the pod before. But yeah, I think you'll really like it.
Yeah, this sounds like you specifically. Right up my streak.
And then, okay, then the next one is one that we've talked about many times.
Lullaby by Leila Slimani, translated by Sam Taylor. A banger of a few years ago, a gnarly little banger. About a nanny who murders the children that she looks after and what had led up to that in terms of her life and her place in the family. And just really dark, really sharp and very memorable, I found, and definitely liked it a lot more than the next book that we got from Leila Slimani, which I think was actually her debut.
Yeah, so her debut was more about sex addiction.
Yeah.
Well, not more about. It was about sex addiction.
Unlike this book, which is not about that.
Which does not feature sex addiction at all, in fact.
In any way.
I don't know why that's kind of tickled me. But yeah, this one, I think memorable is the exact word. Like, the scene with the chicken carcass is just so etched into my brain.
Yeah.
And then also the hide-and-seek game. Whereas, like, if I'm really honest, like, All About Sarah, I read several months ago, and I can't really remember any scenes from it at all.
Just that you liked it. Doesn't
mean I love it, yeah. But yeah, like, it didn't quite, like, get under my skin in the way that Lullaby did.
Yeah, Lullaby definitely gets under your skin, I think.
Okay, and then the last one I have, and I said France, I guess I actually meant French, because this book has nothing to do with France, it's set in Brussels. This is actually from a Catalan author. It's got nothing to do with France. It's just that she's in Brussels. So I think I read the back and made a mistake. The reason why I didn't know that is because this is on my TBR, but I really wanted to mention it because it looks fucking wicked. So this one, it's called Permafrost by Eva Baltazar, translated by Julia Sanchez. And yeah, this one is about a... no bullshit lesbian narrator who is an uninhibited lover, a wickedly funny observer of modern life. And basically she's from Barcelona, but she's desperate to get out, so she heads to Brussels. Quote, because a city whose symbol is a little boy pissing was a city I knew I could like.
True.
Doesn't it just sound so good? Yeah. And then so basically it's about her like moving around. She moves to Scotland for a while and discovers that she hates the color green. And yet she's just is kind of chasing happiness, chasing sex, chasing love affairs, and also trying to escape her very kind of dark mental health. So it sounds like simultaneously really funny and witty, but also it's circling suicide, which just sounds like a really unique book. So yeah, I meant to bring this up at the end as just like what's something that I'm going to read next, but like a fool, I labeled it as a French book, so I fucked it. Do you forgive me?
I forgive you, and it sounds really good.
Okay, where should we go next on our adventure?
Let's go to the north. Let's go to Norway and Greenland.
Gorge. Have you read either of these?
I've read both of them. We did an episode on it.
Oh, Beesh. Yay! I can't remember anything, man. I can't remember a thing. Okay.
So, first up, we have Crimson by Niviaq Korneliusson, which is written in Greenlandic and translated by the author. Unlike a lot of the other texts, which are translated by someone else, this one was translated by the person who wrote it, which I think is very interesting. And it's about four young queer people living in the capital of Greenland and just about their kind of social lives, their interactions, their romance and their kind of everyday lives as young people in Greenland. And I don't know about you, Alice, but I certainly have not read another book set in Greenland in my life.
Nope.
Especially not a book in translation from Greenlandic.
So I just discovered that it was written in Greenlandic. Then she translated it into Danish. And then Anna Halliger translated it from Danish into English.
Interesting.
Yeah, isn't that fucking interesting?
Hmm.
But yeah, it's just, this is basically, I remember saying about this at the time, it's kind of the exact sort of thing I like to read. It's young queer people being a bit messy.
Yeah, and I feel like that's what I mean when I was talking about, like, there isn't necessarily a culture or a language from which I like to read translated fiction. I just like to read the kind of fiction that I like to read, but from another culture's point of view or from another language's point of view.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, and just seeing what that completely different, like, experience or language or whatever brings to a similar subject matter. And obviously in this instance, it's really interesting about, you know, what it's like to live in such a small community, in such a kind of isolated world, and, you know, a kind of semi-homogeneous world as well, and to be, like, queer in that environment.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's the kind of book that I feel like we're very lucky to have.
Agree.
And also, it does make me think as well, like, of... So this book was translated by the author into Danish, presumably... Greenlandic is a language that you perhaps have fewer translators for. So it does make me think about, like, what other fiction of this ilk we're missing out on purely because
it's seen as difficult. Too niche. Yeah.
Or it's just simply difficult to
facilitate. Yeah.
Yeah. To source the translators for it, or even to, like, for it to end up on your radar to begin with. Like, I think that it very accurately on the back compares it to Irvine Welsh's Trainspotting, but then also Sally Rooney's Conversations with Friends. Interesting. You disagree with that?
No, it's just, yeah, I just think I learn nothing from, you know, it's just one of those things where it's like having an endorsement from, like, Matt Haig, where I'm like, I learn nothing from this. And I love Conversations with Friends, but it's just one of those things that it's just so, like, everywhere that I'm like, this means literally nothing to me. And I don't necessarily, this adds nothing in terms of value judgment to how I perceive this.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I wonder if partly the reason why it's compared to, oh, I mean, that, sorry, you know what though? Both of those comparisons did come from author endorsements rather than, like,
The publisher.
But yeah, I mean, this was published in 2018, so I guess Conversations with Friends was still very much on everyone's lips at that point.
Yeah.
So next we're going to go to Norway with Paradise Rot by Jenny Haval, translated by Mariam Idris. So this one is, again, it's another book. I feel like there's quite a few books of this ilk. It's about a young woman who's in a new country for university. She's moved into this shared house with a woman who is basically has, you know, she has very poor boundaries. She's very kind of eccentric and quite larger than life, if I remember correctly. And it's about how they're it's about their relationship and how this living situation starts to impact this woman, Jo's, life. The main thing I remember about this is that the house is rotten through.
Yes, mushrooms and growing everywhere.
Yeah, there's this theme of fungi sprouting up all over the place. I really, really, I remember really liking it, but it is another one of those books that I can't really remember much about it now.
Yeah, I agree. I remember the vibe, but I don't remember the content.
Yes, exactly. Strong vibe. And she's another one of her books has now been translated and published by Verso, which I'm yet to read. But I really did like it. I liked the grossness of this book because I like quite gross stories. I like gross things. I'm the kind of person that will always, sniff the weird rotten jar in the fridge. I'll be right in there. And that's what this book felt like to me.
Yeah, agree. Agree.
Okay, that's enough of that. Where to next? Oh, yeah, so I in my quest to, broaden my horizons in terms of, languages that we're going to be talking about today, I pulled My Brilliant Friend off the shelf as an example of Italian translated fiction. But I haven't read it. Have you read it?
Yeah, I have read it and I loved it. And I've read her, her standalone books as well, which I really loved. I would actually like to revisit this series, so maybe I'll do that on audiobook. And
let's do an episode because I haven't read them.
Yeah, I would hope you would like them. I don't know for sure, but yeah, it's just, this series is basically the story of the life of a girl throughout her life and her relationship with her childhood best friend and their romances. And but yeah, she just has this really incredible style that there is just something about her writing that makes you understand why people got so into it.
Because I remember it felt like they all popped off at once, even though they were released separately.
Yeah, it was and people were able to kind of read them back to back.
Yeah.
I was going to say it is also delightful to read something that is set in and around Naples. It's just really, it's got such a good location and, just really, I really found it delightful to read it from a kind of just knowing what people's everyday lives were like and what the, what things look like and what shops they went to and just this kind of very everyday texture of the book I found really compelling and, I loved it.
Yeah, which actually is something that I do particularly like about reading translated fiction is you do learn more about a particular space and time, and it's something that I really enjoyed reading Japanese fiction now having been to Japan.
Yeah.
It just lands slightly differently.
Agree.
Okay, I think that we should commit to doing an episode on at least the first one.
Yes.
And if I don't like it, then I will say so. I'll be honest. I'll wear my heart on my sleeve and I'll tell the pod exactly why.
Quite right.
Okay, so I think... Oh yeah, then I also got a German...
Let's finish our little tour of Europe and then move on to South America.
Okay. So I was just going to talk about a book called The Muscle Feast by Birgit van der Beek. I don't know who translated this one though, because I don't have a physical copy of it. And sometimes these things be quite hard to find. But have you read this one?
No, I haven't even heard of it.
So it's one of those kind of contemporary classics. You would potentially recognise the cover. It's a 90s book with a very memorable cover of an illustration of a pot of mussels. Anyway, this is about a family who are sitting down. It's a novella about a family sitting down to dinner. Basically, it's a mother and her two children have prepared a feast of mussels for the father of the family, but he's late coming home. So while the whole book is set around the table while they wait for him, and it's all about what's not said. And basically, as they reflect upon their family and think about the meal they're about to eat, the real situation starts to become clear. That's the best way I can describe it.
No, this sounds very intriguing.
Yeah, again, like many of the books we discussed today, it's very dark. And it's also more explicitly So it's obviously, it's written in 1990, so it's also kind of examining the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Mm.
Which is not necessarily something that I would turn towards. But yeah, it's all about uncomfortable relationships and all the things that you cannot necessarily say until you are alone.
Yes.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, no, this sounds good. I don't recognize the cover. Apparently it was translated from German by Jamie Bullock. So yeah, I just wanted to put that on the record. But no, this sounds good. Yeah, literally never heard of it. Really, it's one of those books.
I probably wouldn't have actually read it. It was picked for my office book club. So yeah, it came to me in quite an unusual way. It's also one of those books that once you finish it, I recommend going online and reading about it. Because there's a huge amount, of like context, historical context that I would not have understood.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly, I think it's quite allegorical as well.
Cool. I'm going to read this. So yeah. I'm going to seek it out.
Okay. So that is the end of our European tour. Let's move to South America.
Let's go down there. So I don't think I have read either of the books that we have got going on in South America.
What? You still haven't read Tender as the Flesh?
I have gone on the record to say I'm not going to read Tender as the Flesh. You've asked me before and I've said I'm not going to read it. I just don't want to. It sounds horrible.
You know what? Fine. I will try. I will not ask you again. So Tender as the Flesh is by Augustina Bastarica and it was translated by Sarah Moses. And we have talked about this before. I don't know why. I just completely failed to remember this. But it's an Argentinian novel about a world in which animal flesh is no longer safe for human consumption. And so the governments initiate a program of breeding something called special meat, which basically means human meat is now legal. It's a really, really gross horror novel. I often see it described as horror. I guess I personally wouldn't have thought of it as horror, but it is certainly dystopian. And it's about both, I think, literally about vegetarianism and the morality of eating meat. But also, I mean, I initially read it as allegorical about capitalism.
Yes.
I think it's a really great book. It's really gross. It's really put me off. I was eating a bowl of gumbo while I was reading it, and I haven't been able to eat gumbo since. It's literally put me off one of my favourite dishes, so
I can't risk that happening to me. I can't.
Yeah,
I can't.
No, exactly. Okay, fine. So that's Tender as the Flesh. As I said, we have talked about it before, so we'll keep it nice and brief. And then the last one is something that I'm not surprised that you haven't read, because I think it's a really... it's quite a niche book. So this is called Bezoa and Other Unsettling Stories by Guadalupe Nettle, translated by Suzanne Jill Levine. Oh, this is a Mexican title, so not South America. Beg your pardon. We're in Central America.
We are now.
So this... but this is basically five or so. So it's incredibly short collection. Six stories that are just incredibly weird. So the first one is from the point of view of the son of a photographer who is a medical photographer, and he takes photographs of patients' eyes as they're undergoing cosmetic eye surgery. And basically, he really falls in love with someone based on a photo of their eye. It's fucking bizarre. Mm. The whole collection is really unsettling and original. I really recommend it. And again, this is a book that we could have put in our novellas and quick reads because it's super short. It's like just over 100 pages. So that yeah, if you want to read really strange Mexican short stories, may I recommend this one to you?
I think I might have it on my shelf somewhere, but I haven't read it. So maybe I will do that.
You know what? You probably do because
Was it published by a friend of the pod and sent to us by friend of the pod, Jordan Taylor-Jones?
It certainly was. So it was published by Seven Stories, who don't really do much in the UK. I think this was Seven Stories is an American publisher. They've set up a UK branch, I think, to start publishing their own work over here. This was the first one. I don't think it necessarily got the attention it deserved because they're a brand new publisher. So, you know, like, even with a publicist as incredible as Jordan, I think it was quite difficult to get it
on the radar of
out there, which is I think also because it's a short story collection, obviously in the UK they're so much more difficult to get people to read. So I really hope that my very brief description of it compels more people to pick it up, because it's just such a treat. And it's very much about, like, the strangeness of people. And it kind of, you know who it kind of reminds me of in a funny sort of way? It reminds me of Ellie Williams.
Interesting.
Not so much on the, like, the language element, but more just, like, stories that focus on the strangeness of people and their idiosyncrasies.
Cool. I'm down.
There you go. All right. So that is about a dozen of our favourite work, translated works by women.
For I Women in Translation least, Month.
Yes, I hope at least something has jumped out at you as a new read that might intrigue you.
And let us know. Let us know if you have picked up any of these books on our recommendation. And let us know what your favourite Women in Translation book is. Please. We would love to hear from you, as always.
And can you believe, at the beginning of our recording sesh, I said to my husband, we've got a shot coming at 1, so if I'm still recording by then, please listen out for it. And you were like, we won't still be recording by then.
We're Look chatty. We love to little, chat.
Little pair of motor mouths.
It's us.
All right, let's call time on this one.
Well, I'm going to go for a run, so I'm not eating my lunchtime ramen too late. And I will see you on the flip side.
See you on the flip side. Bye!
Bye.